An unjust law is no law at all. Or for those with a bit of Latin, lex injusta, lex non est. That little phrase, as far as we can tell, first formulated somewhat differently by St. Augustine in the first book of On Free Choice of the Will, holds an entire world within it. Eventually, I'll return to St. Augustine and some profound things he says about law and justice. But I'd like to begin with today and work our way backwards. Last month, President Donald Trump became the first president to attend the annual March for Life in Washington, D.C., an event that commemorates, by way of opposition, the Supreme Court's decision in Roe v. Wade, published on January 22, 1973. In the course of his public remarks before the march, President Trump declared his ongoing support for the Little Sisters of the Poor. The Little Sisters, among others, have been involved in a legal battle connected to the Affordable Care Act since 2012. And in the coming months, they'll be returning to the Supreme Court for the third time. In the fall of 2017, the Trump administration released revised rules governing the provision of female contraceptives to employee-provided health insurance plans. Although the Affordable Care Act, signed into law by President Obama in 2010, does not explicitly require contraceptive coverage, the Obama administration announced implementation rules finalized in 2012, according to which FDA-approved contraceptives must be provided by employer-provided health care plans free of charge, that is, without requiring copay, for women of reproductive age if prescribed by health care providers. Although churches and other houses of worship could receive an exemption on religious freedom grounds, no exceptions were provided for Christian hospitals, Christian charities, Christian colleges or universities, or other religious organizations that opposed it. Since 2012, a wide-ranging court battle has been fought over this so-called contraception mandate. Religious nonprofit organizations were eventually allowed an accommodation rather than the exemption allowed to churches and other houses of worship. If the Little Sisters of the Poor, for example, one of the most prominent plaintiffs in the courts, were unwilling to provide their employees health insurance plans that covered contraceptives, they were required to submit paperwork to the Department of Health and Human Services, their insurer, or their third-party provider, stating their good faith objections. The insurer or third-party provider would then be required to provide these services directly to the employees free of charge. Much of the court battle has been fought over this accommodation, and the Little Sisters, among many others, have argued that the submission of the required paperwork is an undue burden on their religious beliefs, since it entangles them in the provision of contraceptives to their employees. In 2016, rather than decide the question, the Supreme Court sent Zubik versus Burwell, a consolidation of six separate lawsuits, including the Little Sisters, back to their respective courts of appeals for reconsideration. This is where things stood when President Trump took office, and in the fall of 2017, his administration revised the rule so that any employer may receive an exemption, rather than an accommodation, from the requirement to provide contraceptives in its health plan if its objections are based on sincerely held religious beliefs or moral convictions. According to the New York Times, the new rule was welcomed by groups like the Little Sisters of the Poor, an order of Roman Catholic nuns who had resisted the Obama administration's mandate because they said, this is still the Times, it would make them morally complicit in grave sin. Since then, numerous states, including, for example, Pennsylvania and California, have sued the federal government, charging that the Trump administration rule is too permissive and violates the Affordable Care Act. Last July, the Third Circuit Court of Appeals ruled against the Little Sisters and the Trump administration rules. The sisters appealed to the Supreme Court, and shortly before the march last month, it was announced that the Supreme Court will hear their appeal. Hence, President Trump's shout out to the Little Sisters. How should we think as a society about the contraception mandate? Is it for some people an unjust law, or in general an unjust law, and perhaps because of this no law at all? If so, how might we respond? Is it the case that the Obama administration is an accommodation, is insufficient, since it would make Catholics morally complicit, perhaps others also, in grave sin? Let's begin with the standard Catholic reference manual on such things, the 1997 Catechism of the Catholic Church. The third section on life in Christ has something to say about our topic in two places. In the Catechism's discussion of the human community, it considers the nature of political authority. After claiming that political authority is natural and good and should be obeyed when legitimately exercised, we get the following passage. And I'll let you know, some of these passages are on the handout that I gave you. Forgive me. I desperately wanted to keep it to just two pages, one piece of paper, so I know it's sort of squished on there, but hopefully it won't be too difficult. So this is passage one from the Catechism. Authority does not derive its moral legitimacy from itself. It must not behave in a despotic manner, but must act for the common good as a moral force based on freedom and a sense of responsibility. A human law has the character of law to the extent it accords with right reason, and thus derives from the eternal law. And so far as it falls short of right reason, it is said to be an unjust law, and thus has not so much the nature of law as of a kind of violence. Authority, still reading, authority is exercised legitimately only when it seeks the common good of the group concerned, and if it employs morally licit means to attain it. If rulers were to enact unjust laws or take measures contrary to the moral order, such arrangements would not be binding in conscience. In such a case, authority breaks down completely and results in shameful abuse. Following the trail of references down the footnote rabbit hole is instructive. The first reference to Gaudium et Spes, Vatican II's 1960s document on the church in the modern world, is focused on properly exercised authority and our duty to obey such authorities. The footnotes in Gaudium et Spes itself highlight Romans 13. This is the second passage. Let every person be subject to the governing authorities. This is Romans. For there's no authority except from God, and those that exist have been instituted by God. Therefore, he who resists the authorities resists what God has appointed, and those who resist will incur judgment. For rulers are not a terror to good conduct, but to bad. When you have no fear of him who is in authority, then do what is good, and you will receive his approval, for he is God's servant for your good. But if you do wrong, be afraid, for he does not bear the sword in vain. He is the servant of God to execute his wrath on the wrongdoer. Therefore, one must be subject, not only to avoid God's wrath, but also for the sake of conscience. The final reference in that first quote, to pacem in terris and shameful abuse, supports its claim with a quotation from St. Thomas Aquinas on unjust laws. Precisely the same quotation that the Catechism itself quotes, that middle section of the first quote that I read just a moment ago. I'll come back to the passage from St. Thomas. But first, consider the second relevant passage in the Catechism, the discussion of civil authority that comes at the end of the treatment of the fourth commandment. This is passage three. The citizens obliged in conscience not to follow the directives of civil authorities when they are contrary to the demands of the moral order, to the fundamental rights of persons, or the teaching of the gospel. Refusing obedience to civil authorities when their demands are contrary to those of an upright conscience, finds its justification in the distinction between serving God and serving the political community. Render therefore to Caesar the things that are Caesar's and to God the things that are God's. We must obey God rather than men. When citizens are under the oppression of a public authority which oversteps its competence, they should still not refuse to give or to do what is objectively demanded of them by the common good. But it is legitimate for them to defend their own rights and those of their fellow citizens against the abuse of this authority within the limits of the natural law and the law of the gospel. That second paragraph, I just quoted in the third passage, ends with a reference to Gaudium et Spes, which takes us back to the passage from Romans 13, number 2, but does not support the specific claim about resisting unjust laws. But here's a concrete example of what the Catechism is referring to, relevant to our own discussion of the contraception mandate and drawn from St. John Paul II's 1995 encyclical Evangelium Vitae, the Gospel of Life. And this is the fourth passage. Laws which legitimize the direct killing of innocent human beings through abortion or euthanasia are in complete opposition to the inviolable right to life proper to every individual. They thus deny the equality of everyone before the law. Laws which authorize or promote abortion and euthanasia are therefore radically opposed not only to the good of the individual, but also to the common good. As such, they are completely lacking in authentic juridical validity. A civil law authorizing abortion or euthanasia ceases by that very fact to be a true, morally binding civil law. There is no obligation in conscience to obey such laws, still reading from John Paul. Instead, there is a grave and clear obligation to oppose them by conscientious objection. From the very beginnings of the Church, the apostolic preaching reminded Christians of their duty to obey legitimately constituted public authorities. There's Romans 13 again. But at the same time, it firmly warned that we must obey God rather than men. In the Old Testament, precisely in regard to threats against life, we find a significant example of resistance to the unjust command of those in authority. After Pharaoh ordered the killing of all newborn males, the Hebrew midwives refused. They did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them, but let the male children live. In the case of an intrinsically unjust law, such as a law permitting abortion or euthanasia, it is therefore never licit to obey it or to take part in a propaganda campaign in favor of such a law or vote for it. End of John Paul. Immediately before this passage, John Paul again quotes the passage from St. Thomas on unjust laws that we have already seen several times, a passage that is woven into most of the prominent discussions in recent church documents of the distinction between a just law and an unjust one. That passage is used by these documents as a shorthand way of referring to St. Thomas's overall framework within which it makes sense to distinguish between just and unjust laws. Let me now turn to Thomas Aquinas himself. This passage from Aquinas is drawn from his so-called treatise on law, questions 90 to 108 of the Prima Secundae of the Summa Theologiae. The heart of that treatise is a fourfold division in types of law: eternal, natural, divine, and human. For how many of you is this division familiar? These four types. St. Thomas concludes the first question, question 90, with his definition of law: an ordinance of reason for the common good made by him who has care of the community and promulgated. A law is nothing other than a rational ordinance, or we might say a principle of order, whose purpose is the ordering of the common good, that is, the ordering of a community. And this promulgated rational ordinance must be made by the right sort of person and communicated to, well, the community. Now, on the back of the handout, I included two visual ways of thinking about the four types of law and their relationship to each other. I'm not going to talk through these. I'd be happy to answer questions about them if anybody wants to raise them, but I hope for at least some of you they're a nice visual representation of what Aquinas is up to. Each of the four types of law, eternal, natural, divine, and human, exhibit these four features: promulgated for the community, from reason, and so on. The natural law is nothing else than the rational creature's participation in the eternal law. God's providence is manifested in rational creatures in a special way, us as rational creatures, such that we can identify this plan ourselves and follow it freely. Human law is the application of natural law to particular and variable circumstances, like which side of the road to drive on. Although Americans tend to think it's part of the natural law that you drive on the right side. And finally, divine law. God's commands for us that go beyond natural law and human law, and that are necessary most of all because we are destined for a supernatural end. An end that our nature and the human laws based on it cannot conceive of. Let me phrase this another way. St. Thomas believes that the universe is an ordered whole, a rational unity of past, present, and future that is held together as a unified totality. We human beings, as intelligent and free, participate in this rational whole in a special way. We can see our place in the universe, how we contribute to its overall order, and how we can fall away from this order if we choose to neglect what that order asks of us, either by ignoring the claims that all human beings are beholden to, or by failing to embody properly the order of the universe in our own particular and very concrete human communities, with all their own diverse, though nevertheless rational, demands. And because we are destined for more than we can know about ourselves, the eternal law also reveals itself to us not only through our natures, but also through the divine voice, showing us the path to a supernatural destiny. The heart of St. Thomas's account of law is the claim that the universe itself follows a rational order, and all other laws flow from that. It's no wonder, then, I think, that Martin Luther King Jr., in his 1963 letter from the Birmingham jail, likely, I think, the most widely read essay he ever wrote, draws on St. Thomas in the midst of the American civil rights struggle that included nonviolent resistance to segregation laws. This is the fifth passage on the handout now from King. One may well ask, he wrote, how can you advocate breaking some laws and obeying others? The answer lies in the fact that there are two types of laws, just and unjust. I would be the first to advocate obeying just laws. One has not only a legal but a moral responsibility to obey just laws. Conversely, one has a moral responsibility to disobey unjust laws. I would agree with St. Augustine that an unjust law is no law at all. Now, what is the difference between the two? How does one determine whether a law is just or unjust? A just law is a man-made code that squares with the moral law or the law of God. An unjust law is a code that is out of harmony with the moral law. To put it in the terms of St. Thomas Aquinas, an unjust law is a human law that is not rooted in eternal law and natural law. King. That last sentence is our ubiquitous St. Thomas quotation, again, though with the syntax flipped around a little, King paraphrases. Notice also that King refers to the law of God or the moral law. The claim that there is an objective order to the universe against which we must measure ourselves and our own legal system is not necessarily Christian or even theistic. It is simply the claim that human laws must conform to a rational order greater than ourselves, and that if they do not, then while they might have the trappings of law, in truth they are nothing but cheap fakes. Our key passage from St. Thomas is from question 93, article 3, but for our purposes this evening, the longer and more important passage occurs in question 96 of the power of human law. Article 4, whether human law binds a man in conscience. Here is St. Thomas, and this is, in certain respects, the most important passage from him that we'll be thinking about. This is number 6. Laws framed by man are either just or unjust. If they be just, they have the power of binding in conscience from the eternal law whence they are derived. On the other hand, laws may be unjust in two ways. First, by being contrary to human good, either in respect of the end, as when an authority imposes on his subjects burdensome laws, conducive not to the common good, but rather to his own cupidity or vainglory, or in respect of the author, as when a man makes a law that goes beyond the power committed to him, or in respect of the form, as when burdens are imposed unequally on the community, although with a view to the common good. The like are acts of violence rather than laws, because, as Augustine says, a law that is not just seems to be no law at all. Wherefore, such laws do not bind in conscience, except perhaps in order to avoid scandal or disturbance, for which cause a man should even yield his right. Secondly, laws may be unjust through being opposed to the divine good. Such are the laws of tyrants inducing to idolatry, or to anything else contrary to the divine law. And laws of this kind must nowise be observed, because as stated in Acts, we ought to obey God rather than men. This is a wonderfully compact and in certain ways difficult passage. And there are some important nuances to St. Thomas's position that will help us think about the contraception mandate. But Thomas also quotes St. Augustine's key passage here, a passage from his De Libero Arbitrio on free choice, which is a fundamental text for St. Thomas's treatise on law. In the 8 questions that consider eternal law, natural law, and positive law, he refers to this text from Augustine 18 times, and it's the primary text for his remarks on the eternal law, the core account of his core concept of his account of law. St. Augustine's De Libero Arbitrio is a remarkable little text that provides a summary of most of St. Augustine's major views, and so handy for those of you too busy to read his Confessions in the City of God. You can be forgiven, I think, for that. Written in dialogue form by a young Augustine, only recently converted to the Catholic faith towards the end of the 4th century, the first few sections consider the nature of God and God's law. And it is these sections that St. Thomas makes use of. The most helpful passage for us to think about comes a little ways after St. Augustine's famous suggestion that it seems to me that an unjust law is no law at all. He's reflecting upon the changeableness of earthly laws. A society might make one law at one time and later revoke this law in favor of another. It's only possible for us to judge the justice of this change if there is a kind of everlasting law against which the legal changes of particular societies can be measured. Here's St. Augustine, and this is number 7. Consider the law that is called the highest reason, which must always be obeyed, and by which the wicked deserve misery, and the good deserve a happy life, and by which the law that we agree to call temporal is rightly enacted and rightly changed. Can anyone of sense deny that this law is unchangeable and eternal? Or can it sometimes be unjust for the wicked to be miserable and the good happy, or for a well-ordered and serious-minded people to choose their own magistrates, while a licentious and worthless people is deprived of this power? Nothing is just and legitimate in the temporal law except that which human beings have derived from the eternal law. For if at one time a people can justly confer honors, and at another time cannot justly do so, this temporal change can be just only because it is derived from the eternal law, according to which it is always just for a serious-minded people to confer honors, but unjust for frivolous people to do so. Why is it so important for us to suppose that there's such a thing as the eternal law? Augustine, like Aquinas, has his own Christian reasons for suggesting there is such a thing. But this passage gestures towards an even deeper philosophical reason for thinking there is an eternal law. Only if there's some legal standard against which we can measure the justice of our own changeable human laws, will it be possible to criticize, rationally, any law at all, or any change in the law? Here's an example. In the midst of the Great Depression, and in the wake of the 1929 stock market crash, the Glass-Steagall Act was passed in the United States as part of the Banking Act of 1933. According to this act, commercial banks, that is, banks that would hold the deposits of ordinary citizens, were prohibited from using their customers' deposits to engage in certain speculative investments. That is, banks could not take your savings and invest it in certain kinds of securities in order to make a profit for themselves. In 1999, Congress repealed the Glass-Steagall Act. After the financial crisis of 2007 to 2008, many people argued that the absence of Glass-Steagall contributed significantly to the crisis, since by 2007 to 2008, commercial banks had made serious investments with customer deposits in the mortgage-backed securities that eventually triggered the Great Recession. In response, the Volcker Rule, named after Paul Volcker, an economist and previous chairman of the Federal Reserve, was passed in 2010 as part of the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act. The Volcker Rule, like the Glass-Steagall Act, prohibits commercial banks from using their customers' deposits to engage in certain forms of investing. How are we to think about these changes in our laws governing commercial banks? Given that all the laws in question were passed or repealed according to proper constitutional procedures, how can we explain these changes over the last century? Suppose something like the Volcker Rule or the Glass-Steagall Act should be in effect for our society. The legal processes themselves will not tell us this, since the same legal processes repealed Glass-Steagall. We need to be able to look towards some standard beyond the laws and processes themselves in order to justify this claim. That is what we mean by the eternal law. And why exactly must the eternal law be unchanging itself? Because if it changes, then we will need a rational explanation as to which form of the eternal law is the right one for us to use. That is, we will need a second order eternal law, eternal law star, as philosophers like to say, according to which we can evaluate the changes in the eternal law, and hence the changes in our positive laws. The alternative, I think, is giving up entirely on the rational criticism of our laws. Unless there is a permanent criterion according to which we can evaluate them, we will be unable to criticize our laws by means of reason. What we'll be left with is a struggle between competing powers that might mask their own motives under the cover of pseudo-rational arguments. While in actual fact, they are merely irrational forces arrayed against one another. I cannot give you a reason for instituting the Volcker Rule. I can only say, well, I for one would certainly like to put such a rule in place. Let's return to St. Thomas, whose place in the tradition in this kind of thinking is assured not so much because he is the deepest source for Catholic Church's views, that place is held by Scripture, of course, but because he so often develops and synthesizes the tradition in ways still not approved upon. That last long passage from St. Thomas, the one that quotes St. Augustine, saying that a law that is not just seems to be no law at all, this is number 6, also gives us a framework for thinking about when it is permissible or required to violate unjust laws. That passage, number 6, divides unjust laws into two sorts, the kinds that violate the human good and the kinds that violate the divine good. Some laws are unjust because they are opposed to the human good. When in 1593, Queen Elizabeth of England, in collaboration with Parliament, required all those who refused to attend services in the Church of England, this mainly meant Catholics, though also some non-conforming Protestants, to return to their homes and never again to travel more than 5 miles from them, their homes without special permission, English Catholics thereby suffered under an unjust law. The law itself was not therefore binding in conscience, but it was also permissible for Catholics to obey it in order to avoid scandal or disturbance. A father might obey the law out of concern for his wife and children, those who depended upon him. And even though the law itself did not bind his conscience, he He did not sin in following it, and his circumstances might have been such that he was required to follow it for the sake of his family. If President Trump signed a law requiring Catholics to pay a special penalty of $1,000 per year, his law would be unjust and would not bind Catholics in conscience. But since paying this penalty does not in itself cause Catholics to sin, we might nevertheless need to obey it for other reasons. And some laws are unjust because they are opposed to the divine good, such as the laws of tyrants, inducing to idolatry or to anything else contrary to the divine law, and we can never observe such laws. We should have in mind the law, for example, of the Roman governor, Pliny the Younger, who in the early 2nd century after Christ required suspected Christians to offer incense to the image of the emperor and then curse Christ or else be executed. Or we might also have in mind the practice of the 17th century Japanese officials who required suspected Christians to trample on the image of Christ or be sent to prison and eventually executed. Some of you might have seen Silence, you know, a few years ago, that dramatizes Shusaku Endo's depiction of this. If President Trump signed a law requiring all citizens to declare their hatred of Christ on pain of death, we Christians would not be able to obey and could only hide or flee. All laws that violate the divine law fall into this second category. According to St. Thomas, the divine law is divided into the law of the Old Testament and the law of the New Testament. The core of the law of the Old Testament is the Ten Commandments, and therefore no law that requires a citizen to violate any of the Ten Commandments can be obeyed. For not only is it an unjust law, but following it requires that you leave the path that would have taken you to God. Some laws are unjust, but you may follow them for other reasons, and perhaps sometimes might be morally required to follow them, like the 5-mile law. Some laws are unjust, and you may never follow them, for to do so would require you to violate divine law, like Pliny the Younger's requirement that Christians curse Christ. How now should we think about the contraceptive man? Let's assume, for the sake of argument, that the Catholic Church is correct in teaching that artificial contraception, when intentionally used so that a couple might enjoy the pleasures of Aphrodite without the risk of pregnancy, is immoral. I've put this formulation in a complicated way for a reason. It's sometimes morally acceptable to use artificial contraception for reasons other than avoiding pregnancy, and it's acceptable to use certain forms to avoid pregnancy in certain cases, such as when the likelihood of rape is high. But the Church's view of the central case, a married couple that wishes to enjoy the pleasures of sex without the risk of pregnancy, is clear. And so a law requiring a married couple to behave contraceptively in this way would be obviously unjust. And because obeying it would violate the divine law, it would also be impermissible to follow such a law. But what about a law that requires the Little Sisters of the Poor to pay for contraceptive services for their employees? Since the use of artificial contraception is not, in and of itself, always immoral, a law requiring the Little Sisters to pay for such services is not immoral ipso facto by its very nature. But I think it's reasonably clear that this law is meant to make it easy for sexually active couples to avoid pregnancy. And as such, I think that for St. Thomas, this would be an unjust law, and hence not binding on one's conscience, insofar as this law is designed to make it easy to avoid pregnancy by artificial means. It's contrary to divine law. But insofar as the law itself does not require citizens to engage in activity directly opposed to divine law, it's merely opposed to the human good. What do I mean here? The Little Sisters of the Poor, at least according to the New York Times, claim that they would be morally complicit in grave sin if they were required to participate in the accommodation provided by the Obama administration. It's not clear to me that this is true, as it would be if this law were clearly contrary to the divine law, as in the case of a law requiring medical students to perform at least one abortion. Or at least, if it is true, it requires some careful explanation. First, the Little Sisters would be, as we say, engaged in material cooperation with respect to the grave sin in question. They're part of the process that makes this impossible. And in this sense, they are cooperating. But they don't intend that the contraceptives be used for immoral purposes. They prefer, after all, that no one make use of them, at least for the sake of straightforward contraceptive sex. They're not formally cooperating, as if they were actively encouraging their employees to use artificial contraception to avoid pregnancy. Formal cooperation refers to the active assent of your will to the particular action, so that you can be said to intend the evil in one way or another. The Little Sisters are not formally cooperating by participating in the accommodation provided by the Obama administration. But sometimes mere material cooperation is also immoral. For example, in 2017, Senators Patty Murray of Washington and Bob Casey of Pennsylvania introduced the Protect Access to Birth Control Act in order to fight President Trump's rollback of the mandate with a legislative replacement for the implementation rule crafted by the Obama administration. I think it's doubtful that Senators Murray and Casey had as their primary purpose the availability of artificial contraceptives for non-contraceptive uses or the protection of women at high risk of being raped. For these reasons, their material cooperation in the contraceptive activity made possible by the bill is morally problematic. But what about the Little Sisters? By filling out the form required by the accommodation process, they are materially cooperating, but it seems to me that their participation is minimal. And for this reason, it would be acceptable to fill out the form if there were weighty reasons to do so. For example, perhaps they do not want to force their employees to find their own insurance, and so they are willing to tolerate their minimal material cooperation so that they might continue to provide health coverage to their employees. We are always obliged to avoid all formal cooperation with evil, and as much material cooperation as is reasonably possible. But all of us are involved in at least some material cooperation, and in particular cases, we must judge whether or not this particular cooperation is worth tolerating, depending on the burdens we must bear if we would escape it. This doesn't mean, of course, that the Little Sisters should not fight the mandate with every legal tool at their command, or that civil disobedience is not permissible. They should fight the law as best they can, and I hope they succeed before the Supreme Court. But sometimes it is acceptable to obey an unjust law, even if in obeying it, we are cooperating with great evil. Such cooperation is not always sinful. If you hold a gun to my head and demand some artificial contraceptives, I can give them to you without any moral culpability. Whereas if you hold a gun to my head and tell me to perform an abortion, it's not morally permissible for me to do so. This seems to me the case at hand with respect to the mandate. It's an unjust law, but it requires only our material cooperation. Such material cooperation might or might not be acceptable, given the seriousness of the circumstances and the possible alternatives. In this case, I don't believe that the initial accommodation of the Obama administration required sinful material cooperation with the Little Sisters. But the Little Sisters should fight the accommodation nonetheless, and they can rightfully claim that the accommodation requires them to participate in activities that violate their religious freedom. And it might later be the case that the appropriate response is civil disobedience of one form or another, rather than acceptance of even more cooperation. St. Thomas, happily enough, has given us an as yet unsurpassed conceptual framework for thinking about all these possibilities. And it's a reminder once again that the perspective of eternity is a great gift to us. How oppressive it would surely be if we had no transcendent criteria against which we might measure the behavior of ourselves and our fellows. Nothing to appeal to besides the particular likes and dislikes of this or that group of people, with rational debate no more than a mask for political power struggles. To believe such of one another is a form of despair. And so the phrase, an unjust law is no law at all, is, for those who stand in the tradition of St. Thomas, most of all an expression of the hopeful conviction that the cosmos is rationally, beautifully, wonderfully made.